Hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the position of the management and staff of Guardian Network.
Morning and welcome to Guardian Radio AM. Today is Friday, January 5th, and it's a little after 11 o'clock in the morning. Once again, this is C.A. Nuri, and I shall be your host for today, as I have a very special guest, my good cousin, Dr. Stephen Arnhem. Dr. Stephen Arnhem was actually away in Frankfurt for the last 5 years pursuing his doctorate's degree. I mean, he pursued it quite a long time, but he was there's Stephen Arnhem. We got to say happy birthday to him, actually.
Happy birthday, Stephen.
Yeah. And he's pursuing his doctorate's degree. He is a history, or at least he was a history professor at University of the Bahamas. I called it COB at the time, was it?
We still called it COB at the time, yes.
COB at the time. But I want people to know you. You're a historian. I love historians, right? I have all kind of historian friends. When I say historian friends, I talk about real historians at the University of the Bahamas who have befriended me, and I challenge them back and forth and invite them back and forth. And the idea that Mr. Iron or Dr. Iron is home, I say, hey, you know you need to come on the show. But Dr. Iron just published a new book. You published a new book to be included in, what's the right word for that, Aaron? Lexicon? No? The library, the official library of the Bahamas? About
National Library.
The National Library, if we had one of those.
The public collection, the collection of public works.
I like that. To be included in the collection of public works, right? The book is called Towards a Democratic Franchise, Suffrage Reform in the 20th Century Bahamas. That's a lot of words. That's a lot of words, by the way, Arnhem. Just letting you know, that's a lot of words. But I want you to read that.
Well, I think it's important to also say that it's published by the Max Planck Institute for Legal History and Legal Theory. Yeah.
It's legal history?
Yeah, for legal history and legal theory.
I wonder what that means.
It's the history of jurisprudence and the development of the law.
So let's ask Dr. Arnhem about that.
Yeah.
Without further ado, Dr. Arnhem, thank you very much for agreeing to come by. I'm excited about your book. I know you had a seminar type of thing yesterday with a whole panel discussing some things. I want to hear about that too and your contribution with that. But I want you to give like a brief narrative of your professional career type of thing so my listening audience know who you are, and then we'll delve into what we're going to talk about.
Okay, well, that's a lot of questions to begin with. So let me talk about how this book came about to start off with. I went to university in Germany, and I came back home in 2004, and I joined the College of the Bahamas as a history lecturer. And I taught at COB from 2004 to the end of 2015. And during that time, a lot of things happened in the country that had to do with the law and that got me interested in the history of the law, the history of our constitution. And one of them, probably the most important thing that happened, was the referendum on, as they phrased it, gender equality in 2016, which came out of the commission chaired by Sean McQueenie, which was appointed in 2012 and reported in 2013.
The Constitutional Reform
Review
Committee.
Commission, yeah. Yes. Yeah. And basically, if you look at the chapter on citizenship in the Bahamian Constitution, it's a long and convoluted list of articles that says you're Bahamian if so-and-so and your mummy or your daddy and where you was born and when you was born and all of that. And the commission recommended a very drastic but very simple change to that and said, get rid of all of that and say, you're Bahamian if one of your parents is Bahamian, period. Unfortunately, the government didn't go with that recommendation and made it very complicated, which is why we had four separate bills going to referendum and If you remember them or if you look at them in detail, you will actually find that because it's a binding referendum, this was a very risky undertaking, because if one bill had passed and another one had failed, our constitution actually would have ended up with more gender inequality rather than less gender inequality. So I was very intrigued by that, and I sort of started to look into the citizenship provisions of our constitution, and I look at how they came about and look at the history of how all this developed, and then it's this rabbit hole that takes you into British citizenship law, because essentially what we have in our constitution is modeled upon the British Citizenship Act of 1948, which was still in effect in 1973 and was just turned into a chapter on of the Bahamian constitution. So I guess one of the people I have to blame for going off to do my PhD on a legal subject is former Prime Minister Perry Christie. And I arrive in Frankfurt in 2016, and I start my research on what back then in my mind was a topic revolving around citizenship and electoral law. And I very quickly discovered that these are really two very separate subjects that you cannot link properly, because the citizenship thing is so much rooted in British practice of the mid-20th century, whereas the election law that we have is very much a Bahamian development of the entire 20th century. The British had their own electoral reforms in the 19th century, but the process was very different. There's very little parallels or similarities. So I separated that and I said, okay, let me focus on election law for my PhD thesis. And the book is the result of that. So I started my PhD in 2016. I finished in 2021. So that's roughly 5.5 years. And the reason I did that in Frankfurt is while I was working on all these legal issues around a referendum and citizenship, I saw this little ad in a newspaper that the Max Planck Institute for European Legal History, as it was called then, was looking for PhD students to work on what they called legal transfers in the common law world. And they just started this new department at the Institute because I think, they never told me that, but I think they were a little bit embarrassed by having their institute called the Institute of European Legal History, and they wanted to get away from the Eurocentricity of it all. Mm-hmm. So they had one new department looking at the common law world. They had another one looking at the Latin American, former Spanish colonial world. And then they wanted to expand it from there. And once those departments were established and we looked at more of the world in general and more of the global south too, came about the name change, and it's now the Max Planck Institute for Legal History and Legal Theory. And I guess that means worldwide.
Yeah.
So that's the idea behind that. So, they had this position advertised, and I went there and I thought, okay, this is wonderful. And it turns out that, of course, I knew that beforehand, but of course it turns out that in order to write a PhD in history, or legal history as it may be, you have to do a lot of archival research.
Yeah.
And the files that I need aren't actually in Nassau, even though it's a Bahamian topic. The files that I need are in London, at the National Archives of the United Kingdom in Kew, just outside of London.
Is there any possibility or any chance that those documents could be, quotation marks, returned to the Bahamas to suggest that they ever belonged to us?
Well, it's actually funny you should mention that, because at the time of independence, this was actually being talked about, and the British government made it very clear that they're not our documents, they're their documents, because they were our colonial masters. They created these documents, and therefore it's theirs. Now, unlike some other former colonies, our archives in Nassau actually have copies of most of these files.
Okay.
But the working conditions at the National Archives in London are actually excellent, whereas the working conditions on Mackay Street aren't exactly excellent. So it's much easier to go to London. The work there is far more productive, and it's also cheaper for the researcher to do it in London, if we don't factor in the cost of travel or living or anything. But if you're in London, it's cheaper to do it there than it would be to do it in Nassau for someone who's already in Nassau. So the Max Planck Institute funded several research trips, long research trips, to London. I spent weeks and probably months in the archives in London. And I went through tens of thousands of files, or pages of files, I should say, in the process of writing this book. And as you said, the subtitle is Suffrage Reform in the 20th Century Bahamas. What that means is the book, basically in the first chapter or introduction, runs through the parliamentary history of the Bahamas from the days of the Eleutheran Adventurers to roughly 1919, during which time the suffrage was basically limited to men who owned property. The real difference between the time of the Eleutheran Adventurers and the Lord Proprietors versus later developments as of 1729, when we had the House of Assembly that we basically still have, is the power that the House of Assembly itself had. So, for instance, during the proprietary period, the House of Assembly could only vote on measures put before it by the governor. And there's a wonderful episode, I think the governor was Cadwallader Jones, I'm not entirely sure, who wanted a bill passed by the House of Assembly. So he had his son position his ships in Nassau Harbor with the cannons pointed at the House of Assembly saying, please pass my bill now.
Wow. Because I'm going to ask you what's the most exciting or interesting thing you found in the archives, and that may be it.
Extortion?
I don't know. There's a lot of interesting things that I came across, little bits, you know, here and there. Anyway, so the core period I'm looking at is 1919, when the Bahamas passed a consolidated election law, basically putting all these little pieces that had been practiced for the past roughly 200 years into a single law. Mm-hmm. And from then on, we see roughly 55, 56 years of very busy reform steps, creating, as of, I would say, roughly 1975, the franchise that we know in the country today. There have been some minor adjustments, but if you ask a Bahamian today versus a Bahamian in 1975 how they experience elections, they will probably not notice many differences in the mechanics of the process. Mm-hmm. So in 1975, we essentially get the franchise that we have today. So I'm looking at this period from 1919, to 1975, and the first big thing that I talk about is the introduction of the secret ballot.
Mm-hmm.
And that was probably the longest and hardest fight there was, because the first calls for the secret ballot had emerged probably in the early 1900s, 1910s, and it took until 1946 until that was achieved once and for all. There was a small step earlier in 1939, I believe it was, when they sort of let a test balloon fly, saying, okay, we're going to try the secret ballot for 5 years only and in New Providence only, and we're going to see how that goes.
30 years, roughly, from the introduction of the idea to the implementation of the law.
Yeah, I'd actually almost say 40.
40.
Yeah.
Is that a reasonable amount of time? Is that an unreasonable delay? Is that the nature of governance in a colonial archipelago, right? So you not only are you away from the center, London, but you also have this archipelagic space. Or is this just a natural function of governance in a Westminster system or in a common law system? Because I was about to say, okay, so I used to think that Perry was taking up, sorry, forgive me, former Prime Minister Christie was doing a Fidel Castro. I show up when I show up. That's foreign policy, right? That's national policy. But I see now that being late may be a part of a political culture, right? These delays, this pace at which the government moves is historic and not necessarily a symptom of a dysfunction within the within Bahamian politics.
Well, I'm going to answer that with a very definite and clear yes and no.
Okay.
So the thing is, of course, in 1919... 1920, 1930, 1940, 1946, we did not have the Westminster system. We had what was called the old representative system. Mm-hmm. The old representative system was very cumbersome, and you'll find in the archival record many governors complaining about it, because the executive power in the colony was vested in the governor and the so-called executive council.
Mm-hmm.
The legislative power was vested in the House of Assembly, and there was no constitutional connection between these two bodies.
Okay.
So the House of Assembly could theoretically pass one set of laws that the executive didn't want, and the executive had no way of getting laws that it wanted or felt it needed passed by the House of Assembly, and they were constantly at odds.
Okay.
And the House of Assembly, as we know, in the early 20th century, was dominated by a small minority of predominantly white businessmen,
mm-hmm.
Who really enjoyed the power they had, because it demanded no accountability from them. So they saw very little, they had very little incentive to change that. To put it mildly. Now, I see you have a question.
No, I have a caller. But I want to engage you. But okay. I also want to know, like, the ethos of the Bahamas circa 1967-73 in your research. What was happening culturally in the Bahamas? What I mean, would majority rule would have happened without the actors here, like, eventually? Or would independence would have come about without this active proponent here locally?
Okay, well, that's jumping ahead a little.
I know, but I'm trying to stretch this hour.
Okay, so can I get back to that in a minute?
Yes, yes. But let's go to the caller. Then we get then you go back and then okay. Come forward.
All right, thanks,
caller. Can you hear me?
Caller, this is Saki in a voice along with you and your guests, and of course, Aaron Neary.
Good morning, sir.
We need justice law in this country called the Bahamas. Doctor, I have a question for you, probably two. Knowing that you had to go to Britain to get your doctorate, right? Because the tools were not here in the Bahamas, right? Is the Bahamas really independent?
Thank you, Bremen.
That's not a bad question, yeah. Bremen. I appreciate that.
After all your research, Dr. Arana, delving into the archives and the records, conceptually, like technically, are we really independent? Like, did you find anything in there that actually suggested we're not actually independent? And functionally, operationally, is this what they intended by independence?
And to that, why isn't some of these information here locally in terms of I getting access on the history or the mechanics of
those things that aren't available in the archive? Why are those particular items not available locally?
Okay, so I actually think these are things that need to be looked at separately in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
Constitutionally, legally, and everything, we are an independent sovereign nation.
Yeah.
Now, what it means in the 21st century for a small archipelagic nation of 400,000 people to be independent is a completely different question. And I think we will probably agree that we are not on an international stage at liberty to act independently at all times. The question, however, would be, who are we dependent on? And mm-hmm. and I would argue we're, in that sense, no longer dependent upon the same colonial power that we were dependent upon until 1973. So if our independence is compromised, In some ways, we allowed ourselves to be compromised, right?
Okay.
As far as the question goes, why I have to go off to pursue a PhD, as far as I'm aware, the University of the Bahamas still does not offer PhD programs. And in many ways, that's a question of resources that the university has and that we as a society are willing to dedicate to education in this country.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a political question that I don't want to get into because I'm not a politician.
Also,
and I don't want to be either.
Right. And to bring in, Dr. Arana indicated that the British government told us these documents actually belong to us, the British government, and will be housed here. Copies of some of the articles, the documents, are available locally. But what Dr. Arana pointed out was that to access them locally actually is more expensive and sort of time-consuming and rigorous than the environment available in Great Britain where the original copies exist. And so thank you, Brayman. It's a great question. But like you say, they have to be separated, segmented, and approached differently.
Right.
For me, I know, let's go back and then we can go forward because I got very excited just now.
Yes. So let's go back to, I think it was Aaron's question about whether 40, 50 years, whatever it was, for the secret ballot to be passed as reasonable.
Yeah.
The Bay Street Boys had very little desire to have the secret ballot passed, right?
Mm-hmm.
In 1919, most elections in the Bahamas weren't even contested. There was a single candidate. So they were elected, in quotation marks, by default. There wasn't even an election held.
Yeah.
If there was a contested election with two or more candidates, people would walk into the polling station and say, publicly, for everyone to hear and everyone to see, I vote for candidate A, I vote for candidate B, and so on. So everyone knew who he was voting for. And of course, if you're the man in a constituency that controls the economy in that constituency, that's a lot of leverage you have as a candidate, because it opens the door wide to what we call victimization.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You didn't vote for me, you don't get a job.
Yeah.
It's really that simple. So it was hoped that the secret ballot would curb these practices and would allow people to vote their conscience.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we actually know from research that was done before the secret ballot was introduced in the Bahamas, we know that really what curbs corrupt practices at elections are laws governing party financing, party spending, campaign financing, campaign spending.
Mm-hmm.
And those we do not have in the Bahamas now.
Yeah.
We never had them, right? But Britain first introduced the secret ballot in the 1870s, and very quickly they found out that in itself wasn't enough. So shortly afterwards, they passed campaign financing laws.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at the history here, and that's what I found very interesting in the research, and it's in the book. The people who dragged their feet on reforming the franchise to become more democratic were the Bay Street Boys.
Mm-hmm.
The colonial office in London, which is, or the governor on the hill, who are often suspected to have been in cahoots with the Bay Street Boys, were actually far more progressive and pushed the Bay Street Boys and tried to force them to pass progressive reform measures.
Mm-hmm.
So I would argue in many ways that it was instrumental to have a local progressive opposition demanding these reforms. One of the first outspoken proponents saying we must have the secret ballot, incidentally, was the publisher of the other newspaper that I'm not sure I'm allowed to mention.
Yeah, mention
them.
Depeche.
Depeche of the Tribune was one of the first outspoken proponents of the secret ballot. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, the governor's stance and the colonial officer's stance has always been as soon as there's a vocal demand with significant support for democratic measures in the Bahamas. We will support them, and we will try within the constitutional powers that we have, which in matters of legislation were very limited, we will try and push the Bay Street Boys and force the Bay Street Boys to pass them.
So long and short, you're saying that the colonial office wanted to give us more independence. However, yes, the UBP, yes, or the Bay Street Boys, yes, instead,
yes,
caused the delay.
Yes.
They was being stubborn.
Absolutely. So it was 1946 that the secret ballot finally became permanent. And for the longest time, I couldn't figure out from the archival record why in 1946 things suddenly happened so quickly, until I find this wonderful reference about an election law that was passed in Northern Ireland just months before. Mm-hmm. And just months before, in Northern Ireland, they introduced a new election law that allowed directors of registered companies to vote. And that's the provision Stafford Sands snuck into the Bahamian 1946 law, and it went unnoticed. Nobody saw it. Everybody focused on the fact that Stafford Sands was finally proposing a law, presenting a bill to Parliament that brought about the secret ballot, but he also snuck in the company vote.
The U.S. have a term for that, right? When they have this huge bill and it's all kinds of things you like, but then is it like a pork belly bill, but they sneak in all kinds of things that you hate, but you're so excited about what's happening on the left, you never look to the right to see how you've been destroyed. Also, just a second note, in your telling of the Statue of Columbus story, D'Artagnan, didn't you share that the governor at the time was sort of very progressive and wanted to do this thing, and it's the people who told him no, like, don't do it. Mm. And I figured that the people being pressured by a political base who coerced them and threatened them and say things like, if you push for this, if you go with the governor, we're going to cut off your credit, we're going to not hire you, you're not going to hire any of your children, right? But it's very interesting to see, because we talked about that in a more modern, more recent conversation.
Your book seems to be constitutional-based. Can it also be labeled a history book? Is there history nuggets within it?
Well, it's it's definitely a legal history book, right? It's the method I use is primarily the historical method, as in I look at primary sources, archival records, to tell the story of how the law developed. So I don't just look at the actual law that was passed, and I don't just analyze the law that was passed and how it worked. I look at the conversations that were had between the various political actors. I look at the way that the newspapers in the Bahamas reported these mm-hmm. developments. I look at the conversations that were had primarily between Government House and the Colonial Office in London. So it's in many ways it is indeed a history book.
Mm-hmm. It's the type of discussion and the type of work that should be taking place in the Senate, right? Mm-hmm. When people when the bill gets to that level and you're determining whether you should pass it or not, those senators should have access to a legal history so they could understand the development of the law, why it developed, reinforced by the context provided by these conversations taking place on the side, right? That's the type of process that should be taking place in the Senate.
So I beg my next question. Who should be eager to purchase this book? Like, what audience? Because I know it's a heavy book. Right. And Aaron mentioned the Senate and the senators should have access to it. Is it a history book or an instructive? What is a big word for instructive?
It becomes instructive, like I say, in the senatorial process, where the law has been passed by the legislature, but the upper house now says, hey, OK, the people want this law, but let's look at the historic context. Right. Let's look at how the law was developed so that we could determine whether this recent amendment to the law will achieve the intended purpose. Did they try this before in the past and it wasn't successful? What were the results? Can we amend the law in this way, but what do we need to add to make it more relevant or useful for today, right? That's the context in which the book or this discussion would be used. It's for high schoolers, for tertiary level people, for any person who wants to enter politics, right? You should have a sound understanding, not just of the law, but how the law has developed.
So let me beg you this question, Dr. Arano. When I was doing research about, and I try to get to independence, and I see, you know, I push you towards that part, because my history towards the Bahamas starts like circa 67, move forward. And I know you pre that, you're still a late 1800s, 1912-ish, I think you call. But 67, right? I want to know, in your research, not necessarily what's in the book, but while you're researching the book, did your research give any revelation about who wanted independence, right? Did independence was pushed by, let's say, the UBP or the PLP or whatever else political party? I want to know if you came across any information like that.
Like, did you find any letters from Abaco, residents of Abaco, business people in
yes.
Abaco to the Home Office, to London, talking about independence, a desire for independence, or the opposite, opposing what was going on the ground?
Okay. All right, so again, different questions, different answers. Let's do the Abaco one really quickly, because that's not absolutely not the focus of my book.
Cool.
Abaco, or a group in Abaco, opposed independence
mm-hmm.
and proposed to the British government that they would do something to Abaco similar to what they've done to the Turks and Caicos Islands, that is, separate them from the Bahamas. Let the Bahamas do their thing, but keep Abaco as a colony. And when that didn't pan out, there was a brief, even weaker effort to turn Abaco into a separate, independent
country.
Nation apart from the Bahamas. Yes, I found those, but I didn't find anything new to that story. In fact, in still the seminal book on Bahamian history, Islanders in the Stream by Gail Sanders
yeah.
and Michael Creighton,
yeah.
There's a wonderful, unfortunately, I think it's hidden in a footnote, and nobody ever reads footnotes. There's a wonderful passage in there about how the Colonial Office responded to Abaco's request to keep them as a separate colony. And that was, and I quote from memory, so I may get it slightly wrong, but essentially it said, rid of you, we want to get rid of the colonies.
They actually said that?
Yes.
Say it again, sorry.
I think the wording was, rid of you, we want to get rid of the colonies.
That was the response to their letter.
That was the response of the Colonial Office. Now, another thing that is interesting that I came across doing my research that is not in the book, because it didn't fit in with the topic, was that twice in that independence period, the British government negotiated with the Bahamian government about the Turks and Caicos.
Mm-hmm.
The first time it was around 1964 when the first constitution had been passed that gave cabinet government to the Bahamas when we had Roland Simonet become premier.
Yeah.
And the second time was around the time of independence. And in both of these instances, the British government actually tried to convince the Bahamian government to take the Turks and Caicos back and make them part of the Bahamas again. And they actually offered the Bahamian government money to take the Turks and Caicos Islands back.
So what happened?
Well, I think in both instances, they didn't offer enough money.
Okay.
And the Bahamian government thought, okay, we are in many ways, you could argue whether that's correct or not, in many ways in the 60s and early 70s, we were more developed than the Turks and Caicos, and it would cost so much to bring the Turks and Caicos to the standard of the rest of the Bahamas, and the British aren't offering us enough to do that. I think, and that becomes very clear in the archival record, that when the UBP turned down that, let's call it offer, when the UBP turned down that offer, they thought, if we take the Turks and Caicos in, they're all going to vote PLP, we don't want that. And when the PLP government rejected that offer, they thought, well, they may all vote UBP, or I think by that time it was already FNM, we don't want that offer.
Wow.
So let me get it clear. So the offer was offered during the UBP leadership era, and then again offered during the PLP leadership era.
That's correct.
And both administrations said, no, we want them.
Yes.
Because and a part of the reason was the economic output required to bring them. And Mayaguana Airport still look like under Tobacco Davao? Yeah.
So, I want more question before we get commercial.
Well, we got to go to commercial.
One more question.
Let me do this read.
I can do the read after the commercial, man. Leave that. Independence. Which administration purported independence, wanted independence? And after that, we go to the commercial.
How quickly do you have to go to commercials? The only political actor in the Bahamas who called for independence and meant it was Randall Forkes. I'm going to give you the rest of the story after the commercial.
Okay. Yeah. Producer, get ready for that guy with that commercial right here. Phil Stubbs, NASA Cruise Port and Zimmer Production presents Phil Stubbs live this January 13th. Also performing is Nishi, LS, and Iris Tour and the Spank Band. Tickets are $50, general admission, $75 VIP, available at BahamasEtickets.com, at the Plantation Bar and Grill Cave Heights, and at Messina. How do you pronounce that?
Miniso
Mall and Marathon. Doors open at 7 p.m. Show time is at 9 p.m. This has been Guardian Radio AM with C.A. Neuro. We'll be right back. We're continuing the conversation with Dr. Stephen Arner. He's back home after 5 years abroad in Frankfurt, pursuing his PhD. Now he has a book called Towards a Democratic Franchise, Suffrage Reform in the 20th Century Bahamas. It's a detailed book. It seems to be a legal history book. It goes in great detail, but now I'm asking about his research and what all he came about across whilst he was in Frankfurt and in England researching. But anyway, we'll be right back with Dr. Stephen Arno.
Love the show? Want to give your support? Become a sponsor today. Call 302-2300 for our rates and packages. That's 302-2300. Become a sponsor on Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
Nassau Cruise Port presents Phil Stubbs Live at the all-new Nassau Cruise Port Amphitheater.
January 13th.
Gates open at 7 p.m., showtime 9 p.m.
Book your tickets now at BahamasEtickets.com.
General admission $50, $75 VIP.
Prepare to be blown away as we kick things off with one of the Bahamas' beloved artists.
You're raking and scraping with Ira Store, Nishi LS, and Phil Stubbs Live.
Sponsored by Kalik and Ron Ricardo. Nassau Cruise Port. The place to be.
This is Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
Boy, I read the last time he took a trip down in Nagua. But this time, we're going to San Salvador.
Say what? You talking about my own town?
Uh-huh.
Over the UE, over the hill, down in the field. You know what I'm saying?
As Iris Store, he's going to be with Phil Stubbs coming up. Which day is it? January 13th?
That's Saturday, January the 13th.
Okay, there's a NASA Cruise Port presents Phil Stubbs live at the Amphitheater on Saturday, January 13th. Join Phil Stubbs, Anishi LS, and Iris Store and the Spank Band for an amazing night of pure Bahamian music sponsored by Click and Ron Ricardo. General admission will be $50. VIP price will be $75. Sky Pods is also available. Get your tickets now at the BahamasEtickets.com. That's Phil Stubbs and friends live at Nassau Cruise Port on Saturday, January 13th. I say 13 probably.
Yeah. 13th. It's Phil Stubbs. It's a Phil Stubbs concert. That's how you're supposed to say it.
13th?
I almost didn't get into the concert because I said 13. 13th. That's it.
January 13th. Don't miss it. And of course, we have Dr. Stephen Arno with us, and we're talking independence again. And I just was baiting him.
But hold on. Information. We're talking about his book, Towards a Democratic Franchise, Suffrage Reform in the 20th Century Bahamas. I just want to say, This is the first time I find a book that has to have its own theme song. And the theme song for this book is, look what you're going to get when you're tired of what you got.
And I also want to talk about what happened yesterday at, where was it, UB? Now, what happened?
So there was a panel discussion at NAGB last night. I think NAGB records all of its events. It was a vibrant discussion. I'm pulling it up right now. Miss Dr. Arana, Keisha Ellis-Hunt, and Miss Hepburn, a art historian. I don't call her a curator yet because the art world gets very technical about their terms. Mm-hmm. But a vibrant thinker and art historian at the university, Miss Hepburn. And Mr. Aaron, I'm pulling up the flyer right now.
You have art historians in the Bahamas?
We have everything in the Bahamas, except for direct access to the archives. The panel discussion was entitled The Intersection of Art and National Political Development. It was a book launch. It was a great conversation. And so we had a presentation by Dr. Arana, then Keisha Ellis-Hunt implored us to re-examine, you know, or redefine what democracy means, right? And so we were having a discussion about what democracy means in the context of what Dr. Arana presented and the reforms experienced in that period. And then the art historian drew the connections between the existing show, the show that's going on at the art gallery right now, and the discussion that Dr. Arana brought to the table. If I could title it, I would call it Justice Doesn't Have to Be Done. It just needs to be seen to be done. So like, they just need to think we did it.
I'm not sure if we can have democracy without the Freedom of Information Act, but we'll talk about that too. But let's go back to Dr. Arana. Independence, the actors, proponents, things that you come across while she's doing your research. Go ahead. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so in many ways, the story of independence starts in the 1960s. And I just said the only Bahamian public figure who steadfastly supported independence early on was Randall Forbes. Now, his role is interesting for a number of reasons. So we look at the 1962 election, and as we all know, that was the first time women voted in the Bahamas.
Mm-hmm.
Now, from the records, we have no way of knowing how women voted in 1962 versus how men voted. In other words, we don't know how women voting for the first time impacted the outcome of the election. But observers ever since then have kind of blamed women for the UBP's win in 1962.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a passage in Randall Forkes' memoirs, The Faith That Moved the Mountain, where he says, women unleashed tremendous power at the 1962 elections, but they unleashed it in the wrong direction. Now, what's interesting about that is Randall Forkes had run in 1956 on a PLP ticket and then had a falling out with the PLP and started his own party, the Labour Party,
mm-hmm.
Which was really a one-man show. They ran two candidates in 1962, and for all of the other constituencies where the Labour Party didn't offer candidates, the Labour Party and Randall Forkes actually supported and endorsed the UBP. So then years later, Randall Forkes saying the women did wrong by voting UBP is a bit hypocritical.
The Labour Party supported the UBP?
Yes.
Continue, go ahead.
They was that mad at, see, I could understand being that mad at the PLP. Yeah. I'm that mad at the PLP right now.
So the footnote is in the book. You can find exactly where that was recorded and in which archival file.
All right. There's a text here that says, now, where do we find the book? They won't go out and buy it right now.
All right. When I wrote the book, when I published the book, I thought I would do one thing, and that is to make it open access. That is, the book is actually available for free as a PDF online for everyone to read.
This boy is a Bahamian. I bought my book, and now I find out it's...
No. I told you that before.
Yeah, no. I good. We good. In fact,
it's reading on PDF anyway.
It's a hard copy. This is a part of a collection, right? It's great to have a PDF copy as well, so that you could read it with ease. But this is also the hardback is what you can put on your bookcase.
Where can you find hardback?
At the moment, I have them. I'm trying to get them into the bookstores. They have not taken the bait yet. I'm working on it. There is, if you Google my name and the title of the book, you will find the publisher's website in Germany, and they do ship worldwide.
Did you bring copies here in Nassau?
Yes, I have about 30 or 40 copies left.
So you have 30, 40 copies left, so you've got to come and get you quickly. What's your phone contact so we can, so if people want to buy it today?
+41 176 433-7-4991
You know your number starts with a plus, right?
You know how far we call in?
I'm trying to say.
We call in via WhatsApp,
WhatsApp.
Right? Are you WhatsApp?
Oh, yeah, that's definitely WhatsApp.
Give me that number again. So you sound adding pluses and stuff. Go ahead.
+41 176 433-7-4991
And how long are you here in Nassau?
Another week.
Another week to buy this book. We have a caller on the line right now. Producer Patrick, call it through. Go ahead, caller. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Hey, Dr. Arno.
Good morning.
Good morning. Talk about the PDF being free. I sure how that is, right? But like how I blind, right? Visually impaired, can't see. You know, the I don't know which if the book on auto book or this, how does PDF thing go, or how do we get it so us blind people could enjoy it? And maybe you're on YouTube, this lecture and all this history teaching, what you've been saying, Rachel, the history of the Bahamas from the proprietors and the 1919s and all of that stuff, all of that information, can we get it on YouTube?
No, it's not on YouTube. I have to admit, I'm sorry, I'm not entirely sure how accessible the PDF is. I gather there's probably software that will read you a PDF.
Yeah, I'm about to say, Papa, there are apps now that if you upload the PDF, it will read it to you.
Okay.
It will turn it into an audio book.
Okay, and so thank you, Ms. Green. But Dr. Arno, can we get your voice maybe, if you have the time, maybe to get your voice and audio maybe to not just the history which you was teaching us just now, the classes, but this book which you have, can you do it in audio for the visually impaired? Can you consider that?
I will have to see if I can do that. The book is like 320 pages. I'm not sure you want to listen to my voice for that long.
Yes,
don't worry, Papa.
Yes, Dr. Arona, the history of the Bam, that'll be good to teach our children.
Papa, Ronnie Butler Jr., who is Ronnie Butler Sr.'s son, is actually an award-winning audio book presenter. What we have to do is we have to bring his services in and see if he would be willing to organize audio documentation of a number of local books for us.
See if you could encourage Dr. Arona to maybe these classes and stuff. I don't know.
That's the next thing. To get him in a YouTube school.
Yeah, get him on YouTube.
And just do little mini lectures.
Even if sometimes we have to pay for it or whatever, but this we could teach our children it. I mean, and although they could see books to read and stuff, it'll be good for it to be on YouTube.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Papa.
Good work.
Thanks. Yeah. I have one more caller I want to squeeze in. So let me squeeze that caller in. And did the PLP wanted independence? I want to ask you that, to your knowledge. But let me squeeze this caller in, and then we go to synopsis about your book again.
And then I want to know about if there's any information about the relationship between A.D. Hanna and Pinling at the road to independence. But that's just me.
Okay, producer, pass the caller through. Let's get this last caller. Go ahead, caller. Can you hear me? Time.
Yes, hello.
Go ahead.
Good afternoon, your guest, CA. I want to know if your guests have read the 67 Royal Commission on the UBB, that they were the most corrupt people of government ever. In 59, when Castro kicked out Maya Lansky out of Cuba, he came to Freeport with millions of dollars. And the MPs who was against it got Crown Line, Staff of Stance, and the Commission was here, and he got $10,000. But he got acres of Crown Land in Freeport and in Nassau for them to vote for gaming. The Commission inquiry made the Royal Commission say the UBP was in the 10 years, from 57 to 67, they give each other, Saudi Lutra, with the ship that bought, George Pickett, the MP, got it for $10,000. It was sold for $10 million to the cruise ship company. And I wish Pinling took some of that crown land back, because Death Army National is back to us as subdivision. They got it free. And some of them pay little or nothing for acres of crown land that the UPP gave to them as an MP. Now, South Asylum was the cabinet minister, but he was Maya Lansky, personal lawyer.
So let me let the doctor respond. I know we have a couple of minutes, actually. Okay. So let's do a synopsis first before we run out of time. And then if you have time, you can respond to that.
Okay, now I'm going to go really quick about the 1967 Royal Commission. Yes, I've read the report. Yes, it's in the archives. Anyone can read it. But it wasn't really relevant to the subject of electoral reform, and therefore I did not deal with it in the book. It is a worthy topic of investigation. I'm not going to deny that. So back to the question of independence. Right. So around comes the 1967 election. And in 1967, the UBP was still the government. At the beginning of 1967, the UBP was still the government. And the PLP ran a campaign during that election saying, we want to continue to be a Bahamian, a British colony. And if you vote for the UBP, they're going to turn the Bahamas into an independent nation.
Wait, the UBP wanted us to be independent, but the PLP didn't?
No, the UBP never talked about independence. The PLP accused the UBP of moving the Bahamas towards independence. And the scenario they painted is the UBP is going to turn the Bahamas into an independent apartheid state like South Africa. That was the scenario the PLP painted at the time. Now, they win the 1967 election, and what's interesting then is they lose interest in all the electoral reforms they had demanded beforehand, because they wanted, for instance, proportional representation. But the moment they realize that the current electoral system that we have can win them an election, they didn't want to fiddle with it anymore. So 1967 comes around, and the PLP wins the government. They win the 68 election, and now they've got a huge majority in the House of Assembly. The UBP basically ceases to exist. And the PLP is quite happy with the status quo, because they have tremendous power within the Bahamas, and they don't have to take care of outside issues like international relations, defense, and so on.
When can you join us again? When are you leaving? How much time do we have to try and get you back into the studio, Dr. Arana?
A couple of days next week. I'm leaving Thursday.
So maybe Monday or Tuesday we make available for you to come on? Absolutely, we have to continue this conversation, because look what you get.
When you're tired again.
When you're tired of what you got.
Especially the electoral reforms that seem to not come in part. Remember, we supposed to be a Freedom of Information Act was to be important?
Yeah, yeah.
And now it ain't important no more?
Even ZNS came out to the presentation at NAGB last night, so you could catch some coverage on there. You could catch the replay of this show. Just go online and search Guardian Radio AM with C.A. Nuri, Guardian Radio 96.9. You'll find it. But stay tuned, because next week we're going to continue this conversation.
And that's a wrap. Guided Radio AM with C.A. Nuri. Aaron Green was with me. Dr. Stephen
Arana.
And his book,
Towards a Democratic Franchise, Suffrage Reform in the 20th Century Bahamas.
Have a wonderful day.
Thank you very much.